In his long career, Steven Pinker has taught us to look behind the obvious to find sometimes grim, sometimes delightful truths. In his new book, he asks us to look at how knowledge works. What we individually know, he argues, is not particularly powerful. What drives society, indeed what's central to how we live, is knowing that what we know is widely known. Steven Pinker calls this common knowledge. He's given his new book the title, When Everyone Knows That Everyone Knows, Common Knowledge and the Science of Harmony, Hypocrisy and Outrage. Steven Pinker, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you.
Steven, take us to the scene of a royal procession. The emperor is naked. Everyone can see it, but nothing happens until...
until the little boy says he hasn't got anything on. Which changes everything. In one version of the story, the obsequious deference turns to ridicule and scorn. Now, we all appreciate the story. What is the story really about? Well, when the little boy said the emperor has nothing on, he wasn't telling anyone anything they didn't already know. They knew that the emperor was naked. Why such a change? Well, by blurting it out within earshot of everyone, everyone now knew that everyone else knew that the emperor was naked. That is, their private knowledge became common knowledge. And crucially, the common knowledge is what props up or undermines relationships of power, status, eminence, and for that matter, every other kind of human relationship is a matter of common knowledge. So the crowds changed their attitude to the emperor from deference to scorn, because deference to power is something that the powerful maintain by common knowledge. You defer to the powerful because they stand their ground and they expect it. They expect it because they know that you'll defer. That can be shattered if everyone realizes some weakness or infirmity or silliness in the esteemed, in the powerful.
And that everybody knows it. And
that, crucially, that everyone knows it. Exactly.
And they laugh.
So I do have a chapter in the book on a set of nonverbal displays, nonverbal communication that aren't like our facial expressions, our smiles, our frowns, our grimaces. But these somehow involve the body in ways that have puzzled people for millennia. Laughter being one of them. If there's a droll observation, okay, we smile, but why is our breathing interrupted? Why is our speech interrupted? Why do we make that conspicuous ha-ha-ha sound? I suggest that it's laughter is a common knowledge generator. That is, when you're laughing, you know you're laughing because your breathing is interrupted. Other people know you're laughing. They can hear it. They know that you're laughing. You know that they know that you know, and so on. In the case of laughter, the purpose is to call attention to some weakness or infirmity or indignity in the butt of the joke, or in yourself, in the case of self-deprecating humor, in order to cut someone down in the pecking order, in the prestige hierarchy. You can do that if you want to undermine someone's dominance, the blowhard, the bully, the politician. You can also do it convivially to signal to your friends that you have no desire to lord anything over them, that the relationship among you is one of equals, and so by gently joshing your pals or by good-naturedly teasing yourself, you're establishing we're all equal here. But you're generating with the laughter, the knowledge that everyone is aware and everyone is aware of the awareness of that weakness, that indignity.
Would you argue further that without common knowledge, there can be no humor? Because humor is about two people or masses of people knowing something in common.
Well, laughter generates the common knowledge. I think that's what it's for. That is if you get the joke and you realize, and then you realize that other people must get it too if they are laughing as well, that shows that some compromising fact about the butt of the joke is common knowledge. You aren't the only one who notices that someone has been foolish or pompous. You know that everyone else knows that everyone else knows it, and then they can no longer maintain that relation of dominance or esteem or prestige.
And it's so powerful.
It's so powerful, and it's one of the things that I point out is that when you actually study laughter in the wild, in real people, in real social interactions, as opposed to looking at, say, comedy clubs or you know, great wits like Oscar Wilde or Winston Churchill, when you actually see what actually makes people laugh in everyday life, you find that it's rarely anything that's particularly funny. And psychologists have done that. They've actually sent out student assistants with a notepad, and they say, for the next couple of weeks, wherever you are, if people laugh, just write down what made them laugh. When you analyze them later, it's amazing how unfunny they are, you know, unless you were there. They're not witticisms, or rarely they are. They're things like, you've got to be kidding, or I can't believe it, or you'll never guess what happened next. And people laugh. And they're usually comments on some frustration, breach of decorum, indignity, frustration, something that shows that you're not as flawless, as esteemed, as perfect as you might claim to be. And it can be used either aggressively or self-deprecatingly. It's one of several nonverbal displays that I suggest have as their function generating common knowledge, another one being blushing. So again, it's very odd that your circulation should care about your observance of social norms. Why, when you have some faux pas, should blood rush to your cheeks? Well, I suggest that what that blood does is it does two things at once. Namely, you feel the heat from the inside, and you know that people can see the reddening from the outside. You know that they know that you can feel the heat from the inside. That is, you know they know that you're blushing, which makes the blush all the more painful, especially when someone says, you're blushing, which can make people blush all the more. It can even make them blush if they hadn't been blushing in the first place.
It's a terrible insult to be told you're blushing.
Although it endears people to the blusher, even though it's very painful to be the blusher. And what it does is what is it all about? What are you signaling? You're signaling, I know you think I've screwed up. Now, why would someone advertise that, broadcast it? They don't even have to think that they're guilty. They may not even be guilty. So when a party suddenly turns towards the birthday boy and starts singing happy birthday to you, the birthday boy often blushes, or the birthday girl. They haven't done anything wrong, but they feel, the center of attention, even though I didn't particularly seek it, but maybe you think I sought it, and I'm disavowing wanting to be the center of attention. And so you may have committed some faux pas, but at least you're not a psychopath, you're not a rule breaker, you're not an anarchist, you're not a loose cannon. I know that you think I've screwed up.
And you're quite domesticated, really. On Radio National, this is Late Night Live, I'm David Maher, and I'm talking to Steven Pinker about common knowledge. Now, Stephen, you make the point that the most important common knowledge in our lives is language.
That's what language evolved for, I would suggest. It's a very quick common knowledge generator, and it can, when someone says something directly, you know what they mean, and they know that you know what they mean, and that can coordinate people. It can bring people on onto the same page. So imagine, a case without language. Say a couple is separated. Let's say they don't have cell phones. One of their cell phone went dead, and they have to rendezvous. How are they going to do it? Well, one person could think, well, she likes to go to the bookstore, so I'll meet her there. But then, oh, wait, she knows that I like to go to the camera store, so she'll actually go there. But wait, she knows that I know that she likes to go to the bookstore, so she'll go there after all. And meanwhile, she's thinking the same thing. Each one of them kind of confounded by this pointless empathy. If they could, what they're lacking is common knowledge. It's not enough to know where the other person is going. You have to know that they know that that's where you're going. But language cuts through that at a stroke. one cell phone call. Hey, let's meet at the in front of the bus station at 3 p.m. and the problem is solved. So coordination problems, let's all meet at a certain time. Let's divide the labor in such and such a way. Let's gang up on someone, hear some gossip about someone. All of these are cheaply and quickly generated by language.
And this is but one example of what you call the power of common knowledge in necessary societies, cooperation, that it is fundamental to cooperation. Cooperation is fundamental to society.
And in a particular kind of cooperation called coordination, that is, you're not necessarily exchanging favors, but it's really important that you do it the same way. An example is driving on the left or on the right. There's no inherent advantage to driving on the left, but there is an advantage to driving on the same side that everyone else drives on. So you're coordinating when you all drive on the same side. It's not as if you're doing someone a favor by driving on the left. You benefit as much as they do and vice versa. But what's crucial is that you all make the same choice. So that's coordination. All of our institutions, our government, our corporations, our nonprofits, our schools, they don't really exist as a pile of bricks or as a logo on stationery. All those can change. They exist as common knowledge. They exist because people think that other people think that other people think that they exist.
And this goes to the power of and the necessity for conventions and the ways in which we most folk value and protect conventions and are rather alarmed. I'm thinking of American politics at the moment, when they see convention upended because this is a violation of common knowledge.
Yes, or at least of common expectation. That's right. And one of the surprises of Donald Trump presidency, I know the people are sick about hearing Donald Trump.
No, they're endlessly fascinated. Keep
going. Well, his particular genius is you can't stop talking about him. But the other part of his genius is that he repeatedly breaches norms that everyone had thought were sacred, that you just can't survive in politics if you breach the norm, such as insulting war veterans or prisoners of war, or commenting on women's appearances in an insulting way, or demeaning your political opponents by calling them stupid or lazy. Things that you just don't do because you know that you don't do them, because everyone knows you don't do them, and he did them. And when it turned out that he could get away with them, it's possible the norm itself unraveled, because the norm exists only because people think it exists. When they stop thinking it exists, it doesn't exist. And so you have imitators like Elon Musk, many members of his cabinet who say what only a few years ago would have been completely inappropriate things. For the CEO of a big corporation to clown around and to spew endless lies that he has to know are lies, that would have been fatal in the era in which there was a norm that you don't do that. Musk shattered that norm after Trump shattered so many norms. We will see whether in the corporate world that norm can hold up despite Elon Musk, or whether you have other people who flout it at that level.
The norms that fascinate me in particular are the norms so fundamental that we don't even realize they're a norm until somebody comes along and shatters it.
Indeed, such as, at least in refined settings like corporations, the government, major institutions, unlike, say, a playground or a barroom, conspicuous bragging is used to be considered just déclassé. It was considered
embarrassing.
Embarrassing, yeah, coarse, stupid. Trump hyperbole about your accomplishments. It would have considered fatal to brag about how much of a genius you are. Likewise, to demean or insult other people who'd previously held office, the previous president. There was just a norm that the office itself ought to command respect. And childish personal desire for for status by boasting, by exaggerating, by lying, by insulting others. That's something that a playground bully does. It's not something that a CEO did, let alone a president of the United States.
But this,
nonetheless, he did it and he survived. He thrived.
Well, we'll see if he survives, of course. But Stephen, this raises the issue that common knowledge does not have to be true.
Well, yes, in which case you could call it common belief, but that is right, or sometimes common expectation. But it's the same dynamic. You're right. It does not. If it's common knowledge, technically it does have to be true. That's what knowledge means. But common belief follows similar dynamics.
In your book, you talk about the way in which common belief in one group versus the common belief of another group is a way in which we define ourselves. It's not necessary. It is not cooperative, except cooperative within that group itself.
Yes, it is a form of coordination. So, for example, no one wants to work 7 days a week, but it's nice if you get a day off. But it's a problem if different people take different days off, because if the salesperson doesn't show up at the store when people want to buy stuff, that isn't going to work. And if the customers stay home when the store is open, that's not going to work either. So you got to agree on which day it's going to be. Now, for Jews, it's Saturday. The Sabbath. Christians, it's Sunday. Neither one is inherently better than the other. But at least before there was great mixing and a melting pot, communities that had their own norms would sometimes have to set themselves off. So often the Jews, to recognize fellow Jews, would have particular signals, wearing the black hat, wearing the side locks, letting the sideburns grow long, are ways where you know that this is a person who eats the same things that I do, stays home from work the same days that I do, and that works just fine within the community. Likewise for another community that may settle on a different equilibrium. Now, of course, in modern societies, there's a lot of mobility, fluidity, assimilation, so we tend to alight on the same days. So now we have a two-day weekend, and that kind of solves the problem. But national holidays, common currency, that is what pieces of paper do you accept as having value? Common technological standards, what shape are your electrical plugs and outlets? They can differ from one country to another, but it's important that within a country, even though they're arbitrary, everyone makes the same choice.
And we know. Look, I wonder if this is partly an explanation for why reform is so hard in political systems, because it is not enough just to let people know what change might be to everyone's advantage. That knowledge has to become common knowledge before there can be change. And that is much more difficult than just informing people.
Well, absolutely. And that is why we have things like ceremonies and public squares and national broadcasts and inaugurations. They generate common knowledge. When you have, so for example, when there is a new president or new prime minister, for them to have power, everyone has to recognize they're the ones in charge, and that has to be done nationwide. And the question is, when do you start changing from deferring to the outgoing prime minister to the new prime minister? Well, if you have an inauguration ceremony, then and everyone sees it televised, well, as of now, we have a new king, we have a new president, we have a new prime minister. We all agree at the same time. A good example of the difficulty and how to overcome it when you have to change something and it has to be common knowledge is when I keep using the example of driving on the left and driving on the right.
Yeah.
Well, at one point, Sweden, which had previously driven on the left, realized that this was becoming a real nuisance.
Oh, they changed over.
They changed over. But the thing is, you can't be the only one who knows that the country has changed over. You can't be the only one driving on the right where everyone is still driving on the left, or vice versa. And they had the problem, how do you make the change everywhere at once? This is quintessentially a problem where you can't do it gradually. You can't have people kind of move over, you know, one centimeter a day until they're already over to the other side. That isn't going to work. So they had they announced when it was going to be. I think it may have been New Year's Day on a particular year. There's a huge advertising campaign beforehand warning people of the switch. When you saw the ad, you knew that your fellow Swedes were seeing the ad. You knew the exact second in which the transition was going to occur, and you could feel confident because everyone knows what midnight is. And so you could feel confident that other people recognize the switch at the same time. You could take the chance of the first time in your life driving on the what used to be the wrong side of the road.
And the Swedes were able to do this. And, you know, when I was much younger, Stephen, we changed from an old-fashioned imperial currency and old-fashioned imperial measurements to decimal currency and metric measurement. And, you know, we did it. And we did it very successfully. But alas, the poor United States, they just can't do it, can they?
Yes,
they can't change.
I moved from a similar country, Canada, another Commonwealth nation, which had the rationality and common sense to switch over. But unfortunately, I moved to a primitive backward country called the United States, where we still have the inches and the Fahrenheit degrees and the 32-degree freezing point.
Is it because of the power of common knowledge that we are now so intent on cancelling people?
I think the common knowledge does enter it. So remember, we spoke a few minutes ago about Donald Trump shattering norms.
Yep.
And, you know, he somehow got away with it even before he was president. But it was risky. And often norms are held in place because they're policed by no one in particular, but everyone at once, recognizing that a norm has been breached in public. That is, it's common knowledge. Everyone sees the violation. Everyone sees everyone else seeing it. But to keep it the norm from unraveling, then the norm breaker has to be punished, has to be singled out also in public. You need the social media shaming mob. You need the petition with 600 signatures.
Right.
The person has to be punished in a visible place. Just as in the past, criminal punishments used to be public for the same reason. You had the gallows in the center of town. You had the pillories and the stocks. You had the burning at the stake, the crucifixions. People would, you know, bring out the kids for an afternoon of entertainment to watch the prisoner being strangled. But this is announced that this is a norm that is going to be published, and you are seeing everyone else seeing it being published. Therefore, you know that the norm holds. Now, this can be a good thing when there are norms that are worth holding. It can be a bad thing when you've got norms that should give way to other things, like, say, in science, the search for the truth. Sometimes a scientific finding might be uncomfortable. If you have a norm that says that, you know, good-thinking people don't believe that, people might try to enforce that norm, whereas it's just inappropriate to do it in a arena like science or journalism or courts of law, where the truth has to override norms of propriety and politeness.
Now, you also argue, and this I find completely compelling, that for society to actually function, you have to pretend, or you have to be able to pretend, that you don't have common knowledge with people that you are engaged with perhaps somebody that you're trying to seduce or somebody that you're trying to employ or something. But there is license to pretend that you're somehow ignorant of common knowledge.
Yes. What prompted me to explore this bit of our psychology many years ago was my interest in language, in particular, puzzlement as to why so much of our language is euphemistic. We don't blurt out what we mean, but we kind of hope that our listener will catch our drift, read between the lines, we beat around the bush, we shilly-shally. An example being sexual seduction, as you mentioned. Would you like to, the old cliche, would you like to come up and see my etchings? That has been replaced by, we want to come up for Netflix and chill. Bribes. If you want to bribe your way into a restaurant where you have no reservation by slipping a $50 bill to the maitre d', you probably wouldn't say, if I give you 50, will you let me jump the queue? You might say, I was wondering if you might have a cancellation, or is there any way that you could shorten my wait? Veiled threats. We all are, have seen mafia pictures in which the wise guy doesn't say, if you don't pay protection money, we'll burn your store down, but might say something like, oh, nice store you got there. It would be a real shame if something happened to it.
So both sides know exactly what this is about, but yeah, they use language that allows them to pretend that there isn't common knowledge.
Well, in fact, there isn't common knowledge. There is private knowledge, but there isn't necessarily common knowledge. There may even be second-order knowledge. You might know that the other person knows that you know, but you may not know that they know that you know that they know that you know. At some level, it breaks down. At least that is true with euphemism, with innuendo, with hints. Even if, you know, no grown woman could really be fooled by the line, you know, do you want to come up for Netflix and chill? But she could still think, well, I know what he's asking, and he knows that I know, but does he know that I know that he knows? Maybe he thinks that I think that I'm naive. And he could also, even though he knows that she may have turned down an overture, he could still think, well, maybe she thinks that I don't get it. Maybe she thinks I'm kind of dense and, you know, on the spectrum, and I don't really realize.
Oh, Stephen, you're making me panic.
So the point is that direct speech, blurting something out, blunt speech in just so many words, that does generate common knowledge. But hints, even if they generate private knowledge, they may keep things out of common knowledge. And here's the punchline. What's so special about avoiding common knowledge? Well, our social relationships depend on common knowledge. If two people are friends, it's because each one knows that the other one knows that they're friends. If they're lovers, each one knows the other one knows. If one of them is dominant and the other one defers, it's because they both know that the other one knows. And so without common knowledge, you can keep intact the social relationship. In the case of the date, it might be platonic friendship. You can maintain the fiction of platonic friendship if you prevent the proposition from being common knowledge.
As you try to seduce each other. Stephen, yeah. On that punchline, I think we should end.
that was blunt.
Stephen, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I've been talking to Stephen Pinker, experimental psychologist, who's written dozens and dozens of books. The latest has the fantastic title, When Everybody Knows That Everyone Knows, Common Knowledge and the Science of Harmony, Hypocrisy and Outrage. This is Late Night Live.